as if he were a character in one of his trick films. Cinema had no memory. You were only as good as your last reel. Of Iwerks was breaking up the band. Could Walt survive without the man who actually did the work? Would Ub be the one who ended up in history's dustbin? Or would neither of them survive the economic disaster that was spreading through the world? Méliès's rediscovery didn't return the French director to filmmaking, after all. He still sold toys. Mickey Mouse might be just another age of ballyhoo fad, filed next to Mahjong and Swallowing Goldfish. Ub's final go-round with Mickey was Wild Waves, which sent the mouse on a shore vacation. It's one of Mickey's best early efforts, and proof that Ub did not get a case of senioritis and what he knew would be his final weeks. In his opening shot, Mickey plucks away at a banjo on a tall lifeguard chair for an audience of seals and birds. Waves crest in whitecaps against the rocks, then subside, then weakly flow forth and ebb back before beginning the whitecap sequence again. Rows of rack and pinion waves would have been much easier, but Ub took the time to display the ocean as it was. In a cabana with a closed door, many changes into a striped bathing outfit that covers more of her than her regular apparel. She skips along the tops of sandcastles, rotten boats, and assorted washed-up debris wearing heels. What a fashionista. When Minnie dips her toe in a tide pool, a colossal wave captures her. Mickey dashes across the deck, power sliding on his feet at the edge. He throws a life preserver, but it boomerangs back at him. Next plan? He skitters to the beach and flips an overturned boat. This disturbs a pair of pigs who were having some quality time. Mickey holds the rowboat single-handed, plunking it in the ocean, but the tide's ebb leaves it high and dry. He rows futilely against the sand and picks up the bottomless boat Flintstone style to avoid being clobbered by a wave. Many flails. Mickey rows out to sea but is chased back to shore by a killer wave, where he relentlessly oars sand. Then the cycle begins again. Out into the waves, then pushed back to shore. Mickey can't stop trying to go, but can't ever succeed in leaving. Walt's gag, Ub's execution, and how fitting this would be some of their last work together. The Sisyphean actions speak to both of their positions. For Ub, no matter how hard he or Mickey worked, his situation would never improve unless he did something different. For Walt, the danger of his loved one being crushed by external forces was worth any risk. Following a gag where he swims in a perfect horizontal while the seas buck and roil, Mickey finally saves Minnie. The waters conspire to keep them apart, on separate hillocks of water. Brave Mickey clutches his girl with one pipe stem arm, while cutting water with the other. When he makes it to the shore, sea lions applaud him with their flippers, in an almost rotoscoped moment of realism. After scooping her up and walking up the shore, Minnie rouses and starts crying.
"Where am I? Where am I?" she pleads. "Don't cry. Don't cry. Take it easy. You're all right,"
Mickey soothes, stroking her arm. He's again voiced by Carl Stalling. As with Mickey's choo-choo, the simplicity of the dialogue sells the realism of the moment more than any joke. Minnie blows her nose on Mickey's monogrammed handkerchief and keeps sobbing. Mickey decides to calm her with a song. He starts an impressive one-man show, whistling, tapping, maneuvering his arms, and rotating his belly inside his shorts as if it were a wooden barrel. Penguins join in the dance, perfect animals for a black and white short. The rest of the short is a sea animal review. Sea lions dance, a baritone walrus serenades, the fluke is the Duke of Soul. Minnie is cheered and smothers Mickey's cheek with kisses. To quote an Ethel Merman song, "Look at Mickey Mouse, look at Minnie Mouse, they just live on love and cheese." This is a near-perfect piece of animation, erasing all the mistakes of the previous year. Gone are the stolen gags, mimeographed animation, and absent characterization. Mickey and Minnie are vibrant, their entire faces alive and expressive. They can emote like Theda Bara and sing like the Carter family. Even when their relationship was as rocky as the on-screen jetty, Walt and Ub were a team to be reckoned with. Disney had finally solved the riddle of what made a good Mickey cartoon. Far-off locales were great, but what audiences loved was singing away your problems. Mickey was not at heart an adventurer or a thrill-seeker. He was an entertainer. So long as Walt could engineer a good-looking short with a new reason for Mickey to burst into song, audiences would be on board. Wild Waves was the best Mickey Mouse cartoon they'd ever made. Walt and Ub would never animate together again. Ub Iwerks' final efforts with Disney were the springtime follow-ups, Summer and Autumn. The last of the quartet, Winter, would follow a few months later. Summer begins with the residents of a wormy apple dancing in the sun, then quick-changing into butterflies. Water striders skate across the surface of an unfrozen lake. A dragonfly pulls water-skiing ladybugs behind it. Two dung beetles lose hold of a packed ball of you-know-what. Autumn begins with ferocious, sharp-toothed squirrels collecting nuts for the winter. The squirrels find ears of corn, which results in a half-eaten cob being played like a music box cylinder. Ub adds other new animals hoarding food, a badger, a porcupine, and beavers. While Ub was toiling away on the seasons, Walt was planning his latest cross-country trip. It had been a year he had successfully delivered 15 Mickey cartoons with pristine sound, and he was halfway toward the goal of a dozen silly symphonies. This would be a far better trip to New York than last year's Charlie Mintz debacle. Pat Powers, Walt knew, should have been flush with cash from all the Mickey Mouse rentals, but envelopes filled with 90% of the rental fees weren't arriving in the mail. Nothing was, in fact. Could the theaters that were spending upwards of $100,000 to get wired for sound be holding back on Powers? Didn't Disney have a hit cartoon? Roy had tried to look at Powers' finances, but he too had been stymied by Powers' slickness. They smelled a rat. Roy made Walt plan for the worst by seeing if MGM would buy Mickey from Powers. No luck. Louis B. Mayer said that pregnant women watched movies and they hated mice. MGM was also, of course, secretly bringing Ub on board. There were other bites, though, from Van Buren and Mascot Pictures and Warner Brothers. Disney's Mouse was a real catch. Roy also prepared for success by filing incorporation papers. It's a big moment when a small business incorporates, especially a month after Black Thursday. Walt Disney Studios was now Walt Disney Productions Limited, with four subcorporations. Animation was now just a quarter of this newly imagined enterprise. Another was for real estate holdings, like their studio space. A third was for film and sound recording. The final quarter was for licensing and merchandising. Incorporating was like carrying protection in your wallet. It only helped if you got lucky. And it was in the zeitgeist to resemble a corporate holding company. 1929 was the year both of Standard Brands and General Foods. Walt brought reinforcements with him to New York to ensure he got a square deal with Powers. Gunther Lessing was a tough-talking, self-mythologizing lawyer. Walt joked he was the only person at the studio important enough to be called Mr. Mr. Lessing claimed to have done legal work for Mexican revolutionary Pancho Villa. If Lessing could handle him, an Irish gladhander should be no problem. Lessing stayed behind at the hotel for the first meeting. Walt didn't want to spook Powers out of the gate. Powers began the meeting by towing the party line of only caring about Mickey as a way of promoting Cinephone. That lasted until Walt demanded to see Powers' books. Powers agreed, provided Walt signed a contract extension first, a legally binding, promise-you-won't-get-mad statement. No go. Walt had signed his last contract without running it by Roy and a lawyer. That was when Powers revealed his pocket kings. He revealed a telegram, not another telegram, from a Los Angeles associate. Ub Iwerks, it read, had just signed on to head a new animation studio for MGM, with Powers as distributor. Walt was stunned. Powers pressed his advantage, telling Walt how much the deal would be worth, how much more Ub was making now, and how big the new studio would be. Walt didn't hear a word. He was too shell-shocked. Walt shouldn't have been so surprised. Neil Gabler reports that Charles Geigerich, Powers' L.A. middleman, was not very cautious about the new deal he was setting up. He had pitched Iwerks' services to animation studios around town well before Iwerks had signed. Gigerich also had tried his own brief end run around Powers, approaching Walt and Roy about being their new distributor. Ub and Powers had arranged to break the news the same day to Roy in Los Angeles and Walt in New York, January 20th, 1930. Roy presumably had stayed in California and sent Lessing in his place because Edna had just had their first child. Roy was now father to one-week-old Roy E. Disney, who would grow up to run the family business. Ub had decided to tell Roy when Walt was away. Roy, more than anyone else, understood what it was like living with Walt. Ub claimed he and Walt had simply butted heads too often, which was true but not the whole truth. Roy offered to put him out of his partnership for $5,000, over $2,000 more than he had paid in. Ub promised to stay for a week to finish Autumn. This was downright amicable. Ub then swore to Roy that he was not going to work for Pat Powers. That was a lie. Ub had sussed out who the man behind Charles Gigerich was. Whither the Mickey Mouse Club refrain, Mickey Mice do not swear, smoke, cheat, or lie. Why did he lie? Well, Roy was being so nice about everything. For someone who drew skeletons, Ub wasn't showing much backbone. Roy made an expensive long-distance call to Walt and was shocked to find out Ub was in fact in bed with Powers. When he approached Ub about it the next day, Ub held his head down and said, I didn't want to call you. Never had quitting felt so much like being fired. Ub didn't return to finish Autumn. In exchange, Roy didn't pay him a cent more in the buyout than he had paid in. Roy and Walt exchanged all caps telegrams on what to do. Roy wanted Ub divested from the company as soon as possible. Suggest stop all publicity immediately on Ub's name, stop. Roy wrote, feel that sooner we have definite release from him, the better, stop. Walt responded, see that we are immediately protected on Mickey Mouse and Silly Symphony trademarks and copyrights in foreign countries, stop. If Ubby's action reaches crew, advise you ridicule it as foolish, as he is being used as cat's paw by Powers and may never make any pictures, stop. In New York, Walt was crushed by the defection. Powers offered to hire Ub back if Walt signed, but that was a worthless promise. If he feels that way, I couldn't work with him, Walt recalled afterwards. Lessing came to all subsequent meetings. The white gloves were off, but not even a lawyer could budge Powers from his demands, and Disney was too cash poor to take it to court. It could only afford to quit Powers if it first re-upped with him. Powers even switched from sticks to carrots, sending Roy a $5,000 check and promising Walt $2,000 a week if he signed. Such are the ways of a mouser. In the wake of a calamity, people can make decisions with a courage they didn't know they possessed. Walt, days after Ub left him, decided to walk away from Pat Powers. That meant walking away from all the money Powers owed him. Powers was flummoxed. Walt was supposed to cave. That way Powers could continue to hollow out Disney until Mickey Mouse could be skip-jumped. Powers never counted on Walt refusing to play ball. The race was on to get a new distributor. Before Walt could pay anyone a visit, Powers jumped on the phone. He told everyone, MGM, the Warners, Columbia, the same message. Whoever signed Walt Disney better get used to the inside of a courthouse. Pat Powers wouldn't let the mouse go without years of lawsuits. The film world knew Powers' reputation. The man blew smoke, but he did not bluff. Walt discovered the fix was in when no one would take Disney on, despite Mickey Mouse's popularity. Walt was no different than any other unemployed man facing a wall of no work here signs. Worry turned to paranoia. He switched hotels and checked in under a fake name, thinking Powers might be trying to hit him with a cease and desist letter. The paranoia worsened. His suitcase had a WED monogram on it. Someone could have seen it and connected the dots. One distributor was willing to take a chance. Columbia Pictures had made $400,000 by distributing the Silly Symphonies. It jumped at the chance to get both Disney serials under the same roof. If Powers wanted to play ball, Columbia was ready. It set up a $25,000 war chest for a possible legal fight. Powers wasn't done scheming, though. A court battle would be costly for both sides with no guaranteed victory, and what Powers ultimately wanted wasn't a cartoon studio or even Mickey Mouse. They were mere means to Green. Switching negotiating tactics, he told Columbia he could buy Disney's contract out. All the Mickeys they wanted, past and present. All it would cost was $50,000 plus royalties. $1 million wasn't enough if it meant never dealing with Pat Powers again. Walt drew a line of credit from Columbia to get his boss out of his life. When you're already in debt up to your knees, sometimes the only escape is to plunge neck deep. The post-Powers glow was short-lived, though. Roy soon discovered Columbia execs had been negotiating with Powers to buy Mickey from a bankrupted Disney. Meet the new distributor. Same as the old distributor. In a telegraph to Roy, Walt said to focus the animators on silly symphonies for the time being. They still owed a dozen sillies to Columbia, after all. Mickey Mouse work would be halted. Walt had no idea what to do with Mickey. He and Ub had just cracked Mickey's code, and now half the mouse's DNA was leaving. Mickey would go on a sabbatical, for however many months or years, until Walt felt okay about bringing him back. Maybe they would never make a Mickey again. It just didn't seem right, without Ub's guidance. Roy told Walt via telegram that Ub would regret leaving Disney. Ub did not even know until 2 days before he received his contract who was behind it. We know how gullible and easily misled Ub is. Not trying to excuse Ub, but I am sure that right now, even though he won't admit it, he regrets very much the outcome. Roy also hoped that Ub would set up shop in New York, otherwise he'd be a constant rival. We hated to lose him, Roy said later, but we weren't mad at him for it. Indeed, it was a financial windfall for the brothers Disney. Henry Ford once called Thomas Edison the world's greatest inventor and world's worst businessman. Edison might have some competition in Ub Iwerks. Get ready to wince, reader. Ub's 1/5 share in the Walt Disney Company, if he'd held on to it, would be worth over $20 billion today. The Iwerks family would be richer than Rupert Murdoch, Mark Zuckerberg, or Steve Jobs. The Iwerkses still could be. Copyright law circa 1928 said whoever's name was on the title card was the owner of the character. Walt Disney's name was on every Mickey Mouse title card, but so was Ub Iwerks's. A case could be made that the Iwerks's estate is due a percentage of all Mickey income. Even worse, the multiple names on the title card might mean the original copyright was invalid. Mickey Mouse might never have been owned by Disney in the first place. There's no record Ub ever looked into trying to claim Mickey in court. He got a little under $3,000 in exchange for his 20% stake in Disney. And that was that. No golden parachute, no consulting agreement, no copyright lawsuits. When he left, his break was clean. Ub would never be credited with another frame of Mickey Mouse. His partnership, his friendship, his relationship with Walt, all over. It was like a divorce, with Walt winning sole custody over Mickey Mouse. Walt wasn't pleased with the outcome either. He couldn't sleep for days. I reached the point where I couldn't even talk on the phone without crying. I was in a highly emotional state, Walt said. It always seemed an innocuous question to ask Walt Disney how he came up with Mickey Mouse. Walt's mischievous answers seemed just the work of a playful storyteller. To truly answer the question, though, would be to tell the story of Walt and Ub's friendship, from spirited beginning to bone-break dissolution. For the rest of his life, to avoid this pain, Walt told happy lies about a cross-county train trip. That was better than reliving the heartbreaking truth. Part 4. Kith, 1930 through 1939. The early bird gets the worm, but the second mouse gets the cheese. David Jakovich. Chapter 21. Flipping Out, 1930. Watching a Disney cartoon was more fun than making one. The hours were long, the rooms were warm, and work a millimeter off true was discarded. Walt didn't always make payroll, so some weeks his employees didn't even get their already small paychecks. Company profits went into new hires, not squaring away old debts. Of iWork's defecting was the last straw for many. They decided to leave with him. Ub didn't mean to start a talent raid, but people follow a leader. And Ub had been a leader to Disney animators. They were trained to be extensions of his masterly arm, just as he was an extension of Walt's brain. If Ub zigged, shouldn't they zig as well? Everybody was conspiring against one another, recalled Friz Freleng, a recent Walt Disney Studios emigre. Everybody had ambition. Everybody wanted to be a producer, and there was no one to work with. In that rabid atmosphere, the truth that Ub had left Disney mutated into a rumor. The legend? Ub didn't quit. Walt fired him. Ub was determined to not make the mistakes Walt did, but Pied Pipering the talent away from Disney was a mistake all his own. Ub wanted to keep his staff small at first. 4 men, including one from Disney, and another from Charlie Mintz's operation. He even lured a brand new Disney hire, a Utah kid named Floyd Godfredson. This did not sit well with Roy. Ub as competition was fine. Ub as an adversary was not. Poaching employees crossed a line. Luckily enough for Disney, Floyd was having second thoughts about jumping ship. Ub let Floyd remain at Disney. Floyd's cold feet were thanks to a talk from Gillett and Jackson. Ub was a great talent and unsurpassed animator, the Disney director said, but Ub wasn't the pendulum that powered the clockwork of the Disney machine. That was Walt. His contributions didn't look like much on any given day, true, but he made Disney. Walt and Ub were a perfect pair, a mind and a hand united. Without Ub's mastery, Walt would have to find other conduits for his ideas. That he could do. But Ub without Walt's passions was a V8 engine with no spark plug. There was a bloodlessness to Ub's work. He was a craftsman, not an artist. To drum himself up and start the wheel greasing for selling his new cartoon series, Ub typed out a press release. iWorks, celebrated cartoonist of the screen, produces new and funnier series with sound, he said, adeptly avoiding the word Disney. His new company on Santa Monica Boulevard in Beverly Hills had the boastful title of Celebrity Pictures, Pat Powers' idea, but everyone would call it iWorks Studio. Ub iWorks now devotes his energy, originality, and skill to the task of surpassing all that he has done heretofore. He starts in where he left off with other subjects in this field. He has added new ideas and has taken advantage of his own new improvements and production methods. In other words, he had nothing. The rest of the country received its energy from coal, wood, and oil, but Hollywood used the steam engine. Respect and status were what opened doors, and no one in animation had more of it in 1930 than Ub iWorks. His ad in the Los Angeles Times for an apprentice to the cartoon film business resulted in a line around the block. Applicants had to ink an animation cell in front of Ub. The steadiest hands got the inking gigs. Ub also hired an art school grad named Chuck Jones to wash and dry the animation cells for reuse. Jones would go on to be the looniest of the Looney Tunes crew. Now that he had a staff, Ub needed one final hire, a funny animal. As he did with Mickey just 18 months ago, Ub started sketching every unclaimed animal he could think of. Critter after critter flew from his pencil, but he kept returning to a character that he developed as an Oswald replacement back in 1928, a frog. Ub had placed a similar frog in a silly symphony. Maybe an amphibian could carry a whole series. Certainly there were no other frogs in animation, and frogs were cute in their own fashion. Sticking with alliteration, the new star was christened Flip the Frog. In a field where every cartoon character looked identical, Flip was unique. He truly resembled a frog, much more than Mickey resembled a mouse. Flip had a huge grinning mouth on his chest, huge eyes where a person's shoulders would be, and long flippered hands and feet. He had buttons running up his torso ending in a bow tie. Ob colored Flip's body green and his underbelly and face yellow. The world would know those color choices. Flip the Frog, Ob decided, was going to be the world's first color cartoon. Technicolor had developed a radiant three-color process. It photographed each frame on three different film stocks and layered them together, like systems of the body in an anatomy textbook. That would be ideal. But Ub knew Roy had an exclusive 2-year contract for Technicolor. Ub also knew, though, that Disney wasn't going to use that option, not with its current finances or expertise. The field was wide open. Three-color was out, but two-color was still available. Picking green and red would allow Flip to be green, with a red bow tie in a brown swamp. Flip was slotted before King of Jazz, a Universal film also bicolored in green and red. Producing color was massively expensive and required an insane amount of lab work. Matrices of gelatin, light exposure to harden the green and red strips, merging them together into a final blank strip of film to soak up the dyes. A Busby Berkeley number has nothing on the machination required for a screenable reel of color film. Ub crammed as many marvels as he could into the first Flip cartoon called Fiddlesticks. Flip sings and plays a piano, both perfectly synced. A background scrolls by for yards, tiled together seamlessly. Crowd scenes somehow have a dozen characters in them, without any darkening from all those overlapping layers of acetate. These were animators' victories, though. A crowd wouldn't notice. What viewers of King of Jazz ended up seeing from Ub was, save for the color, indistinguishable from a silly symphony. Animals making crazy music except with a frog bandleader. Flip's piano and stool even come alive and dance, just as they did for Mickey. Ub didn't bother giving Flip a personality. Let everyone else copy Mickey Mouse. Ub would copy Oswald. Mickey is still present in Fiddlesticks, and not metaphorically. 3.5 minutes into Fiddlesticks, Flip hops on the three-stump stage, and a certain round-eared mouse enters. Mickey plays on a violin, and Flip joins on piano. Then Flip ignores the mouse to start playing his own tune. Hard not to take that as a passive-aggressive message to Walt. Disney could have sued if Flip actually used Mickey, but Ub knew exactly how Mickey-ish a mouse could look without drawing a lawsuit. So this mouse is one big legal loophole. He is not wearing shorts but a skirt. He is noticeably taller than Mickey. He doesn't wear shoes. His ears are smaller. His snout is longer. And he has vampiric teeth and whiskers. It looks, in fact, like Walt's Mortimer Mouse. Another coded message, perhaps. Here's what Mickey would be without Ub. Despite color, Fiddlesticks fizzled upon its release. One reason was bad booking. King of Jazz was in color already, lessening the appeal of it as a short. King of Jazz was already a review film, with one of the segments a Walter Lantz cartoon, with an Oswald cameo. Might as well open an apple cart in front of a buffet. Ub was accidentally sandbagged by his own business partners. Walt did his part to ensure Fiddlesticks flopped. After hearing that Ub's new character was a frog, he did exactly what he was scared Charlie Mintz would do if he heard of Mickey. The next silly symphony was called Night, and it featured 4 minutes of frog jokes. Night beat Fiddlesticks to theaters by 3 weeks and was printed on blue-tinted stock. Colorful cartoon frogs? It's been done. Both men found ways to shank each other's cartoons. Color made a big splash, but it was an expensive one-time stunt. All other Flip cartoons would be in black and white. Ub didn't want to burn MGM's money or overextend his crew with a mountain of work. For better or for worse, Ub would not be another Walt Disney. Even without the expense of color, Ub was burning through money fast. He even had to start paying $125 per episode for patent rights for using clear cells. Making the best cartoons wasn't enough anymore. The cartoons had to be hits. Flip's second outing, Flying Fists, had Flip training for a boxing match against a turtle. Ub invented loads of new gags. A punching bag turns into an angry boxing-gloved spider, and repurposed old ones, such as tobacco spit ringing a bell. Flip and Big Turtle's fight is truly epic. Flip clenches the turtle, which turns into a hug, and then the two start dancing. Flip cuts it short with a kick, but the turtle ducks inside his shell. Then Flip kicks his head out. Then the head recoils and hits Flip. That cleverness is missing from the first post of Mickey Mouse cartoon called Just Mickey. Walt was hitting the bottle. That is, it was a bottle episode where the setting was bottled in one location to save budget on backgrounds and crowd shot animation. Were things falling apart that badly in Ub's absence? Just Mickey is 1 6-minute shot of Mickey playing the violin. That's it. Nothing else happens. MGM weighed in with notes about how Ub could improve Flip. Walt would have told them where they could stick their ideas. Ub, though, took every note. First, Flip started wearing clothes. Then he moved from the swamp to a small town. Then he lost his froggy look and was billed simply as Flip. Soon he could be mistaken for Cartoondom's other Flip, the pickaninny friend of Little Nemo. Flip gained a co-star in a beehive-haired old lady with a long nose and longer chin and hung out with people instead of animals. Then came the copying. Spooks is the bonier sequel to The Haunted House. Circus is a three-ringed update of The Carnival Kid. Stormy Seas is Wild Waves on a Boat. He borrowed characters, too. Besides Mickey, you can see Hortensia, Pete the Cat, and Clarabelle Cow, as well as a dead ringer for Betty Boop. If MGM wanted Disney-style cartoons, Ub could deliver, but he couldn't make them better than he had with Walt. Ub's solution was to stop making Disney films and start making iWorks films. Time to put his ideas front and center. Walt chased laughs like a dog in traffic, sometimes at the expense of characterization or story. Ub would put story front and center. Sure, there were laughs, but they came out of the tension of the situation, not buffoonery. Pace became key. So much happened in a Flip cartoon you couldn't turn to talk to your friend without missing something. There was not a second of fat, incredible considering Ub used to excel at plotless dance-a-thons. Mickey was stuck as an aw-shucks character. Ub worked hard to keep Flip a utility man. In Jailbird, Flip was a guard trying to stop prisoners escaping. In Room Runners, he became the truant sneaking out on his bill. Flip's voice went from mezzo-soprano to basso profondo between cartoons. It takes a mouse to be an everyman, a 1931 Terry Ramsey piece notes. Ub was tired of the everyman and made Flip an anyman. He had no defined characteristics. Flip was the anti-Mickey. Animators began considering iWorks Studio the best cartoon house in the world and referred to Flip, Mickey, and Felix as equals. French newspapers wrote love letters to Ub. Ub let his staff participate in plotting and directing. That freedom drew talent all the way from New York. You can see the iWorks style of storytelling everywhere. Looney Tunes, Ren and Stimpy, and especially Pixar put great emphasis on story. This triumph did not carry over to the iWorks' home life. Ub was a small business owner now, which meant longer hours doing the grunt work. The weekends of socializing with Walt Lilly and Roy Edna were through. To give his staff breathing room, he would grab an in-betweener or two, and in 1 week knock out an entire 7-minute cartoon by himself. Ub was not working banker's hours. Ub looked at animation and the world with the eyes of a curious engineer. Fiddlesticks taught him to keep painting backgrounds in color, since it made for more distinctive grays. If there was an on-screen wagon, its wheels would be perfectly round. But this surface gloss hit a hollow core. Ub had nothing to say about the world, no defining truths that snuck into his work. Flip the Frog was fast-paced entertainment, nothing more. This was also Flip's greatest strength, the range of Lon Chaney. But Flip was a character actor in a world of stars. Flip would be respected, admired, but never loved the way Mickey Mouse was. iWorks Studio was a superior animation machine to Disney's, faster, stronger, leaner, and cheaper. But Ub's prowess and innovation were focused on small-ball dreams of keeping costs down and increasing usable work. There was no bigger picture, no insane and exciting next step. Ob was too busy doing what would have been Roy's job, as well as his own. He had little time left to be Walt. Chapter 22. Ideating. 1930. Walt's eyeballs were not bulging a foot from his skull. His temple veins did not pulse like a beating heart. His chattering teeth did not send out wireless messages. Steam did not vent from his ears. But that's how he would have been drawn. He had lost his good right arm, Richard Hubler noted. Life after Iwerks was rougher than sandpaper. Columbia was paying about $7,000 for each cartoon, but Walt couldn't push his expenses down below six. The $25,000 line of credit from Columbia hung over his head, an anvil on a fraying rope. Unless something changed, it would never be paid off. The old Pathé camera had to be retired after 7 years of service. A Universal took its place. Walt had his team redraw anything not up to snuff, but mistakes still fell through the cracks. More bad news piled on a week after Ub Iwerks left, when Walt's other KCMO friend, Carl Stalling, left. To keep him around, the brothers had given Carl an Iwerks-style piece of the pie, one-third of all Silly Symphony profits. But according to Roy, the issue wasn't money. Carl was losing his hearing. Presumably he wanted to leave with dignity before he was fired. Roy paid him back in full, plus $2,000 Carl had invested in the recording equipment, and the Disneys regained full controlling interest. As with Iwerks, this breakup started politely, but ended in raised voices. Walt was glummer still after this second defection, so Roy pep-talked his brother. If we had deliberately planned to use Ub and Carl over the period of time we really needed them, Roy wrote, when they were essential to the success of the pictures, and had planned and plotted to throw them over at the first opportunity for selfish motives, the whole affair could not have worked out prettier. Grasping at straws for insults, Walt invented a new reason why Ub left. The legend Take Two. Ub Iwerks was a layabout. Animators started hearing stories from Walt that Iwerks spent more time at Disney fixing his car than drawing. It didn't take, and only reinforced, the equally false legend that Iwerks was fired out of petty jealousy. He was becoming a living, breathing martyr. Walt kept poking at the unhealed psychic scar. Why, for instance, would Powers woo Iwerks away unless he felt Iwerks was the brains of the operation? Was Walt so bad he didn't deserve to run a studio anymore? Had he been coasting off Iwerks' success? Roy buoyed his brother. The year to come will show them all who is really responsible for Mickey Mouse. The remainder of the staff was in accord. Iwerks could animate like no other, but there was something about Walt's connection with Mickey that struck a chord. Walt Disney was no gold brick. Nothing seemed easy. Sol Field Publishing wanted a Mickey coloring book. Someone had to create that. Borgfeldt started sublicensing Mickey Mouse toy licenses to other companies, prompting visions of Pat Powers to surely leap into Walt's head. People in Japan were hand-painting Mickey Mouse toothbrush holders. How was anyone supposed to check the quality of that? When the great director Sergei Eisenstein stopped by the studio, Walt had to give him a Mickey strip drawn by Iwerks, his new rival. Good thing 1930 was the year Tums was invented. Walt was familiar with the flop sweat of failure, and this wasn't that. This wasn't even scraping by. Was this success? Mickey had just gotten a wax figure of himself at Madame Tussauds in London, after all. The Mickey strip was bringing in about $700 a month in profits, more with every paper that started running it. In Walt's hands was the brass ring he had been reaching for his whole life, and it was heavy. Walt needed to get some work off his plate. The Mickey Mouse strip was gaining popularity. At first, it was only carried by the New York Daily Mirror, but Le Petit Parisien, the world's largest newspaper at the time, would start running it in French. Wynn Smith, Iwerks' former assistant, had taken over penciling duties. Walt asked Smith, who was a decade older than Walt, to take over writing as well. No goddamn young whippersnapper's going to tell me what to do, Smith said in response, and quit. Smith was soon prepping a Flip the Frog comic for Iwerks. See? Nothing was easy. After a few weeks of rotating artists, Walt found an artist whose storytelling he liked. It was Floyd Gottfredson, who had resisted the urge to run off to Iwerks. Floyd handled the strip, soup to nuts, plot, script, pencils, and inks, all based on Mickey's screen adventure. It was one of the first examples of transmedia storytelling. King Features wanted continuity, Floyd said. In other words, a regular story and plot. Walt suggested concepts. Mickey opens a mini-golf course. Mickey becomes a boxing trainer. And Floyd took it from there. He would cram so much detail into each frame, Walt would occasionally ask for some of the damn junk to be whited out. Under Floyd's pen, Mickey became talkative again, while still a mouse of action. Horace Horsecollar and Clarabelle Cow were introduced as an older couple for double dates with Mickey and Minnie. As Walt's contributions waned, Floyd experimented with a serial format. A Mickey story would build and build for months. Iwerks' gallivanting version of Mickey was alive and well, if only in the strips. On the screen, Mickey and Minnie were sometimes paramours, sometimes strangers, but on the page, they were inseparable. In a September 1930 storyline, the sinister Mr. Slicker was wooing Minnie and ruining her father financially so she would be forced to marry him. Shades of Pat Powers. Walt pitched a plot twist to Floyd. Mickey Mouse grows distraught and for a full week tries to kill himself. The jokes would come from Mickey never being able to finish the job. Suicide as a gag.
Walt, you're kidding, Floyd said.
No, I'm not kidding, Walt replied. I think you could get a lot of funny stuff out of that. American humor was rife with suicide jokes, especially attempted suicide. Good taste was phasing that joke out of circulation, since the suicide rate would noticeably increase during the Great Depression. But Walt would give the self-inflicted chestnut one last go-round. On October 18, 1930, newspapers published a despondent Mickey for three panels, lovelorn and unable to feel joy. In the final panel, he solemnly reaches on tiptoes for a rifle hung on a wall. The next day began with the rifle aimed at Mickey, a string around the trigger, and Mickey pledging to drift into the hereafter. Comedy. A cuckoo clock interrupts Mickey's brief walk into William Faulkner country. That's how Floyd found the humor in suicide. Mickey is always comically saved. When he leaps off a bridge, he lands in a boat. When he tries gassing himself, a squirrel tapes a balloon to the nozzle. He ties himself to an anvil and is about to throw himself in the river, but it looks too cold. Only after hanging himself from a tree limb doesn't work out, does he recant. Walt never was as dire as Mickey, but the nation was getting worse and worse, and Mickey would reflect that pain. Characters sported patched clothing, repaired tires, and most telling of all, had hungry bellies. Even inside Disney, things were tight. A quote from The Time has it that Walt took 2 7/8 cents out of every 3 cents he got and put it back into studio experiments. That's how Roy paid for a soundstage to be added in 1930. Walt weathered the Great Depression because his only investment was Disney. All that money ended up all on screen. No cartoon looked as good. The opening shot of the first post-Iwerks silly symphony, Cannibal Capers, for instance, was a complicated dolly shot of swaying palm trees. Gillett worked with Walt to come up with a gag for the shot. The swaying palm trees are really the long legs and grass skirts of dancing villagers. After having him riding the pine, sitting on the bench a few months, Walt was feeling confident enough to bring his starter back on the field. Columbia Pictures Corp. present Walt Disney's Mickey Mouse. A new title slide read, Mickey and Minnie hold up a small blackboard with The Barnyard Concert written on it. Walt also added an end slide in the variable weight lines of a Bill Nolan, one final brand reinforcement. Ub had worked on The Barnyard Concert a bit before leaving, and it feels like a standard Mickey in a variety of shots, pacing, and quality. There's a plot of sorts. Mickey tries to get his animal band through a song. Having an all-animal orchestra allows the Ouroborean gag of animals playing other animals as instruments. Mickey ends the bit soaked and sobbing, his concert ruined, and the audience sorry for the little tyrant. The first truly post-Iwerks Disney cartoon was Frolicking Fish, a silly. Poses were key to Iwerksian animation economy. All characters reverted to a baseline pose. This was fine for when Mickey cut a rug, but it could look unnatural and boring. Norm Ferguson fixed that. He brought with him a trick of the trade from Paul Terry's bargain basement Aesop's Fables studio. Disney is the Tiffany's in this business, Terry said, and I am the Woolworth's. Norm imported a new style of pose work that made animation more limber. Characters flowed through the postures like gymnasts instead of weightlifters. The eponymous Frolicking Fish and the Silly Symphony are balletic in their movement, selling the undersea concept of nonstop movement. The end result is the difference between a connect-the-dots drawn with a ruler and one drawn with one continuous brush stroke. Walt liked the idea of overlapping action, possibly because it wasn't Iwerks' idea. Over the next few months, all his animators drifted away from point-to-point navigation. Eliminating the farrago of recycled frames added work, but improved the quality. The octopus in Frolicking Fish and the caravan of adrift animals in Arctic Antics, Iwerks' final Disney short, looked noticeably closer to lifelike. Walt also stressed a separation of the different parts of animation. No more one-man band operations. The new way, which took a year to codify, involved drawing rough wireframes of characters, drawing key poses of the wireframe in action, and photographing them, rough, for a pencil test. Once they were fine-tuned, the rough poses were cleaned up into full pencils by an assistant. Only then came the in-betweener. This tripled the output of each animator, since those in training were doing the scut work. It also saddened the animators, since they drew wireframes now, not drawings. A director never touched pencil to animation paper, said one former Disney employee. Most animators were now halfway to joining that club. They supervised the assistants who did the actual animating. Another exorcism from the Iwerks school of thought. The endless variety of symphony topics allowed for animators to test out new tricks. The glow of a firefly, the diffuse image of underwater movement, a quavering reflection in a still lake, the dissolving of one cell. Let Iwerks have his color. There were plenty of other innovations that could make a Disney cartoon look technically superior. Walt could out Iwerks Iwerks. Walt also had Disney's prize pig, Mickey Mouse. The Cactus Kid was a Western that in its first two shots alone doubled the locations and tripled the cast of just Mickey. Floyd had written an Old West storyline for comic strip Mickey and his better gags, Mickey accidentally drawing on Pete with an umbrella and Pete using a cactus as a riding crop, made it into the comic. Floyd in turn stole a gag where Peg Leg Pete got his leg stuck in a knot hole. The short ends with a thriller of a shootout. Dark save for gunfire, and silent save for gunshots and screams. Walt, who directed, experimented with only diegetic music. It worked in this scene, but melodrama usually falls flat without the Greek chorus of the score underlying the scene's emotional reality. The Cactus Kid was Walt's final cartoon as a regular director. He passed the baton to Burt Gillett, whose softer touch with Mickey was proving to be a blessing. Gillett carried over Floyd Gottfredson's Community of Intelligent Animals to the big screen. Mickey used to be the only talking animal around, but now they were everywhere. Employed as firefighters, do-si-doing at town dances, jailed for crimes, even visiting the zoo. Don't think about that one too hard. Bert made Mickey his own in other ways. A Mickey always needed music. If that meant Mickey was given a piano as a birthday present, or one washed up on a deserted island, so be it. Mickey was invariably friendly and brave, with a heart of gold. He never backed down from a fight, even if he was petrified. Mickey cartoons began not with a little slate, but with a memo from Walt. He would describe the broad strokes of an idea, say Mickey as a radio show host. He'd include what animals and backgrounds would be needed. Next came a story conference with writers and the director, where the hard work of gagging it up was done. Everyone tossed in new concepts and revisited old cartoons for ideas to be reheated. Then it was time to name and assemble the cartoon. This one would be called The Barnyard Broadcast. The first gag comes right away. The station identification notes turn out to be horseshoes suspended like wind chimes. Walt had suggested that Horace, Clarabelle, and Minnie form a hillbilly band with Mickey the broadcaster. The gag men had latitude to add in small details, dissolves of radio listeners at home, and large ones. Most of the cartoon turns into a war between Mickey and cats who are eating the wiring. The topsy-turviness of a big mouse chasing small cats is never underlined. Walt's original idea revolved around a hillbilly band, but what his staff came up with turned into yet another Romana Clay takedown of their boss. Witness Mickey's showmanship, his quick temper, his desire for perfection, his single-minded grit, the way he savages everything in his way. They all fit Walt to a T. Mickey could no longer be a balance of Walt's and Ub's best qualities. The fearless bon vivant mixed with Citizen Mick. So he would become a mix of Walt's best and worst qualities. Living beings change, and so would Mickey. He was a being raised in a one-parent home now, and he would resemble his remaining father more and more. Chapter 23 Plutocrat, 1931. The Great Depression had not yet hit California. Disney was an exemplar. In 1931, Disney expanded the studio again, adding a new wing for animators and directors. Profit margins were narrow as always. Roy estimated that to cover all expenses, he needed to bring in $1,250 a day. The four quadrants of Disney each needed to pull its own weight. Roy started licensing Mickey Mouse greeting cards to Kansas City's Hall Brothers, who would later change their company name to Hallmark, and to a theater group that toured with a Mickey Mouse stage show. That largesse would change. The Dust Bowl of that year in the Midwest would begin a pilgrimage as hundreds of thousands fled to the West Coast's orchards and valleys. The Los Angeles chief of police would start turning away these desperate tin can tourists at the county line, calling the barricade the Bum Brigade. John Steinbeck immortalized this struggle in The Grapes of Wrath. In real life, Steinbeck's joads would have been roadblocked. New phrases entered the lexicon. Bonus Army, Bennett Buggies, and Hoovervilles. Humanity was in short supply. If the Great Depression was bad for people, it was worse for dogs. For the millions who couldn't feed their family, the pets stopped mattering. Families either put their animals down or let them run wild. Dog catchers back then might have more rightfully been called dog shooters, as was shown in Disney's The Mad Dog cartoon. Starving, begging mutts became a regular sight. Owning a pet was a status symbol. Dogs weren't considered family members, Susan or Lee noted. They were at best co-workers. Even pedigree wasn't respected. The American Kennel Club had no obedience trials yet, and purebreds weren't expected to behave any better than pastured stallions. A trained dog was a circus act, something rare and worth paying money to see. Dogs were regulars in Disney cartoons, both the four-legged and walking upright varieties. Iwerks's three-year-old style sheets kept dogs looking pretty much the same. Pendulous, basset hound ears, elongated snouts, long, lean bodies. Other than the occasional dachshund or bulldog, Disney pooches looked like a cross between a bloodhound and a sub sandwich. That wasn't the case in print. Floyd Gottfredson included a dozen different dog breeds in the early days. His Toontown, later called Mouston, was so crowded there wasn't room for Mickey some days. One puzzling moment came from The Chain Gang, a 1930 jailbreak short where Mickey is chased by hounds who bark fiercely at the camera. Mickey ends up falling off a cliff into the same prison he escaped, where his new cellmates are talking dogs. Wait, So guard dogs exist in a world with talking dogs? How can that be? The answer was that just as Mickey Mouse is not really a mouse, men with dog faces are not dogs. They exist alongside their unevolved kin. This allows Horace Horsecollar to ride a horse and explains why there are so few jokes about Mickey loving cheese or Minnie having a litter of pups every 3 weeks. Just repeat to yourself, "It's just a show. I should really just relax." The same model of hound that chased Mickey was used to different effect in The Picnic. Minnie asks if she can bring her little Rover. Rover, when he shows up, is sweet, affectionate, flea-bitten, and willing to trot along behind Mickey and Minnie in their two-seater convertible. When the picnic gets rained out, Mickey uses Rover's tail as a windshield wiper. To quote Shakespeare, okay, Shakespeare in Love, The Picnic had everything audiences wanted. Comedy, love, and a bit with a dog. Walt had The Picnic cartoon adapted for a week's worth of Mickey strips in January 1931, with Rover redrawn as the extra-large Tiny. The name Rover came from movies, from the popular 1905 melodrama Rescued by Rover. He was the first of many dog stars, including Charlie Chaplin's mutt, Scraps, German shepherds named Strongheart and Peter the Great, and the world's favorite canine, Ren Tin Tin. A good dog deserved a good name. Despite a decade's worth of funny animal cartoons, Walt's cartoons never counted as animal films. His furry stars were basically people who talked, walked, danced, and emoted. An animal who acted like an animal would bring a whole new audience to the Mickeys. Unfortunately, dog movies had disappeared from theaters for the same reason they were such a hit during the silent era. Dogs don't do dialogue. Then news got out that billions of miles away, a new planet had been discovered. All this time, spinning next to Neptune and Uranus was Pluto. Pluto, the planet, was named for the Greek god of the underworld, and because its discoverer, Percival Lowell, had the initials PL. Pluto fever descended on America. A name previously associated only with laxatives, Thomas Wolfe name drops Pluto water in Look Homeward Angel, was now everywhere. A frisbee-style pie plate was a Pluto platter. A new radioactive element was named plutonium. No one at Disney remembers who renamed Minnie's dog, but everything circa 1931 was being named Pluto. Pluto became a regular feature in Mickey strips, a legitimate co-star. He had a penchant for extreme close-ups that showed off his snout's black whiskers like a 5 o'clock shadow. He's a sniffer, a slinker, a brave dog, a scared dog, loyal and determined and true. Most Pluto cartoons are devoted to dogs acting as much like dogs as possible. America loved dogs. There's a reason why screenwriting lingo calls an action that tenderizes a tough character a petting the dog moment. The centerpiece of The Moose Hunt is a game of fetch gone wrong. Mickey throws a stick, and Pluto retrieves a much bigger one. Its branches stick out like moose antlers. Mickey sees it and shoots. We then hear an awful screech of pain, which is edited out of reruns. The next shot is Mickey at his wounded dog's side. Mickey weeps pints of tears, begging the heavens not to let his friend die. Face after grief-stricken face shuffles past, a wonder of animation. He even breaks the fourth wall to ask if there's a doctor in the audience. It's heartbreakingly sincere. What makes the whole scene palatable is a tiny action. Pluto winks. That changes the scene. Pluto is fine, but Mickey doesn't know. We can appreciate his loss without sharing in it. "Oh, speak to me, say something, say something," Mickey sobs, to which Pluto rises, bats his eyelashes coquettishly, holds his arms together and says, "Kiss me." "Yes," Pluto talks. In The Mouse Hunt alone, he yells, "A moose," while hunting, and, since no one had said it in a while, took a knee and proclaimed, "Mammy." In The Birthday Party, he stands upright, too. Walt soon cottoned to the fact that people loved Pluto the pup because Pluto was a dog and dogs don't walk and talk. The closest Pluto comes to speaking again would be an unheard whisper in The Brave Little Tailor. Like Harpo Marx, he chooses to stay silent. Pluto became the American Mutt. He was every good dog you ever knew and several bad ones, a constant cloud of fleas, mud, slobber, speed lines, and water flowed from his muzzle.